Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Jay Michaels and Mary Elizabeth McCary.
Hi.
Here at the Passion Pit Podcast for another week.
Yay.
Now, do you hear that music in the background? That's adventure. This week, we're talking to two journeymen in the arts, Perry Yaniv and Jan Ewing. Now, Perry Yaniv, this year, well, not this year, 2018, was a nonstop journey for him. He worked with several different theater companies, one right after the other, and he worked with several different productions, all award winners, all highly rated, the whole works. Perry Yaniv seems to be a luck charm in these shows. And so we're going to talk to this journeyman about going nonstop in the theater.
Hey, Jay.
Hey, Perry Yaniv. At last, I could get you on the line. Well, to put it mildly, if I'm on the line, then you're on the air. So welcome to my podcast. Really thrilled to have you. You're my human interest story. Oh, you are too kind. You're my human interest story, if you will. To give our listeners some background, I met you when you did a reading of mine, like 2 or 3 years ago. And you were just this guy that was referred to me, and now you have absolutely become one of the most visible names in independent theater. It seems every show that I'm seeing, every show I'm doing, there you are. You are one ambitious person. What's the line that they say? You're the busiest man in show business. Tell us about yourself. Tell us about Perry Yaniv. Tell the audience all about you.
Well, I've been in love with acting and theater for a very long time, and I always had a lot of insecurities and self-doubt about my abilities and whether I was supposed to be doing any of this. And no one ever really told me, like, oh, yeah, you should be a phenomenal actor. Go study that. Go do that. And so I really sort of took it upon myself to train, to work as much as possible, and to sort of kind of go through all of the, I feel like, rites of passage that some actors go through in order to work, you know, in order to sort of serve the thing that I love. So in that sense, I feel like I'm a true amateur, or amateur, as it were. I have friends who are in every level of business, and, you know, I love watching them do extremely well and make livings at it. But there's something about independent theater that I really have a soft spot in my heart for, simply because it really is a DIY, do-it-yourself community where, you know, we're working oftentimes with very little, but we are still looking to make an impact. We're looking to affect people in very specific and personal ways. And I think that that's a real calling. You know, it's a true gift. And I guess I've just been lucky enough to stick around long enough to watch a lot of work that I put in come to fruition. You know, I've been doing this for a while. I think actually the reading we did was closer to like 5 or 6 years ago. It's been a while. And, I'm really just sort of eager to see sort of what the companies that I've worked with before are doing now. I love the fact that you branched out so brilliantly and you have such a wonderful directorial sensibility that I think you apply it to PR in a really, really beautiful way. And I think that's why you're working a lot as well. You know, I feel like every show I do, I'm like, oh, there's Jay. And it's a pleasure, you know, because I think that at the end of the day, it's a very small community. It's very tight-knit in a lot of respects. And I think people who work a lot, I would hope that speaks to the quality of their work, that they're not just putting people in. Because at the end of the day, you know, yeah, sure, I work a lot, but I wouldn't say I'm like a name. No one knows me, you know. I just sort of like show up. I want to serve playwrights and directors, and I love working with, you know, actors who love to work, and that's usually how good things happen, hopefully. You know, you can only hope that the shows that you work on do well, and that the visions that everyone has are executed properly. You know?
See, you're a humble soul, I got to tell you. So that brings me to my next question. The shows that you've done, we've all had that moment where someone says, "Hey, were you in that?" And you go, "Please, please, don't remind me." I'm sure we all had that, but most recently, at least in the past year or two with you, I don't think you can say that. I'm not sure. I have this expression: are you a genius by accident or on purpose? The shows you've picked have been huge and powerful, and they've gone on to other things, and they have been well received. Do you have what's the word I'm thinking of? Do you have a plan as to how you pick shows? Do you have a criteria, a checklist where you say, okay, I guess the best way to put it is, what grabs you? What makes you say, I'm auditioning for this one, but not this one?
If it's an audition situation, it definitely has to be something about the project substance-wise. So what is the story we're telling, and what is the nature or the tone of the play? And if it's an audition, half the time, they don't even have the full script to really make that judgment off of. So you kind of have to go off your gut. But most recently, and I'd say definitely in the past year or two, it's been a blessing to have just been asked to work on projects. So I think the only thing I auditioned for this year was The Roots, which they were remounting, and that was something that I kind of felt take hold of me immediately, because I feel like I got the tone, and this is what the favorite was going for, and everything else has been much more about, you know, the people involved, or the company that's producing, or, you know, at the end of the day, it's really, you know, do I like the script, do I like the story, and, you know, do I love the character enough to go out and fight for them for, you know, 3 months. Those are really the big things for me. Is the character interesting to me, or is it going to teach me something? Am I going to work with people who I'm going to learn from? And is this journey going to keep me engaged? You know, I think sometimes we get excited about projects for different reasons, of course. If I'm like halfway through a process, you know, there's something lacking in the script or the rehearsal or whatever, and you start to lose interest. And it's very easy, because we are putting a lot of sort of extra time into it, that is not, you know, earning us a living wage, that resentment can build up. And so for me, it's really important to be really clear about with myself about what I'm getting into. And 9 times out of 10, you know, your gut reaction is usually right. If you see red flags, those are probably there for a reason. And there are times that I've gone forward anyway, because I believe in the project, or I believe in the company, or I believe in the script. And at the end of the day, you know, if I am in that place, then I know, you know, well, you knew what you were getting into, and that there's nothing to really be upset about, because you're working, you know, like, and this is what you want to do. So at the end of the day, you know, the process is always very different from the results. And I'm very much about the process and wanting to, you know, get as much out of a rehearsal period as possible, and out of the performance, is, you know, however, wherever, whenever they are. But, you know, it's always a roller coaster, it's always a ride.
And of course.
You kind of have to be buckled in for all of it, you know?
Anthony Scher, who played Richard III, I think for the Royal Shakespeare, many years ago, many decades ago, wrote a book called The Year of the King, and he spoke about his process in terms of becoming Richard III. And ironically, the last chapter, which was the shortest, was about the performance, and the show ran, and it was lovely, and everyone received accolades. The end. Exactly. So it sounds to me almost like you're in the same vein, in the sense that it's about the process, it's about what you're taking away from the show, not so much, oh boy, we had a full house and whatever. It's about what you're walking away with in terms of the show.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you want to make a life as an actor, you know, if you're going to be a lifer, if you're in it for the long haul, which the best teachers I ever had explained, like, that's what it's really about, then you have to be in love with the process. Otherwise, you're not going to get anything out of it, because, you know, the result is for the audience. The result is for, you know, whoever's coming to see or write about it or whatever. And it's, That's their side of the coin. You know, as an actor, whether you're doing theater or film, you know, there are a number of films I've done that I've never seen, and I probably don't want to. You know, I'm so invested in What is this story that I have to tell? What is my job? What character elements have I not worked on yet? Like, what needs to happen? You know, what am I short on? What am I afraid of? You know, those are all things that if you are not interested in the process, then you're not going to do that work. It's just, there's, believe me, social media takes care of enough of you know, your marketing life that it's very easy to, you know, do the opposite. And I think we're living in an age now where actors now kind of are responsible for having all those spaces covered where that was definitely not the case before.
Right.
So, yeah, I think, you know, if you are interested in actually acting, then, you know, your life is a life of process.
Well put. Very well put. How's the show you're working on now? I know I grabbed you just as you came back from rehearsal. How is Till We Meet Again, directed by, and I just spoke to her, Tonya Pinkins, and written by Glory Cadogan. How is it?
I'm loving it. I think it's a lovely variety. You know, I worked with Glory in the past as a director, and I'm a huge fan of Tonya. And, you know, I definitely signed up for this for the two of them. And we've done a reading of this almost a year ago. And the ride that this play takes you on is definitely a doozy. And so it's been a lot of work of sort of trying to figure out interpretively how to tell the story that is on the page and not sort of tip our hands or play things in any sort of anticipatory way. It's a very, very beautiful, macabre, kind of mysterious script and story, and things unfold in these very sort of enticing and shocking ways. And so putting that together as the actors, again, we're talking about process, has been a challenge because there's so many little details. It's almost like putting a mosaic together, but you sort of don't want to show the whole picture right away. You really want things to sort of add up for the audience. And so finding ways to do that has been very rigorous and intense and challenging, but you know, knowing Glory, I know that's what she goes for. That's how she works.
Completely,
and,
yes.
And you know, I have a huge respect for that. You know, it's not about sort of everyone shows up on the first day of rehearsal and like, okay, we got it all right, great. Okay, you know, now we're just gonna like hang out for 3 weeks. Like, no, it's a constant sort of back to the drawing board situation. And you know, you really get to sort of test your mettle and see what you're made of. And again, that's a learning process. And there's a lot to gain from that if you have the sort of well-evolved patience to investigate, you know, where you're holding and where your tensions are. And really sort of working past that, I think it's, you know, it makes you a stronger artist, much more pliable. And I look for that.
John Gielgud had played Hamlet. I think he played it 3 times in his life, and he brought a different Hamlet each time he did it. And when someone said, "Well, what did you do when you did it this time?" Whatever, and he said, "It doesn't matter because I am a different John Gielgud now. So I give you a different Hamlet." And it was really quite brilliant putting it that way. And this is always an interesting question when you look at commercial theater as well as independent theater. What do you have to do as a person? What do you feel you need to do as a person? How do you fill your tanks, if you will, so that at one point you were in Raft of the Medusa and you were playing someone dying of AIDS, and then you were in Caligula, oh my God, and then you were in the Bedbug and over and in the Brutes, you had so many diverse characters. What do you need to have as a person to be able to tap into this diversity of characters?
That's a really good question. I consider myself fortunate enough to have a day job and a family, and I'm surrounded by, you know, lovely friends and people that constantly fill me and feed me. I work in a hospital doing asthma research with children and teenagers, and sort of working with kids and families in a clinical setting has been really a wonderful challenge because it forces you to be very objective on one hand, but incredibly personable and almost nurturing on the other. And for me, those two elements are a huge part of my daily life now. And so that, I think, does a huge job sort of feeding me in terms of like the world I live in, and being very present with people who oftentimes would not go see a play, might go to the movies. But, you know, there's a very different world out there. And sort of staying keyed in with that level of reality, I think, really allows me to go further with my imagination when I'm playing. Like when I'm in a theatrical or film situation, you know, I spend a lot of time, you know, in this, you know, I'm of this city. I'm very much a New Yorker. So I feel like that's sort of what is constantly stimulating and feeding me. And I feel like my job is then just to step into the realm and let all the things that are stimulated, you know, all the stimulus out and share it and infuse as much as I can. And that's not to say I don't have a pretty decent research process. I'm very research heavy in my work, because for me it's about, you know, how can I bring truth to this? And it's usually my truth, but I like to layer in, you know, what are the real elements that can pass this over, make this believable. And for me, you know, there's always one thing I'll choose that will help me sort of bridge into what the character's perception might be, or something from an imagined life they've had. And I'm not too big on, like, you know, drilling technique into my work beyond what I think its purpose serves, but I'm very much into human observation and really sort of like that one little thing that might be really obvious that I hadn't thought of, it will then become, you know, the ritual for my sort of pathway in to a character. If that makes any sense.
That makes total sense.
Where did I talk about acting? It feels like very sort of esoteric or self-involved, and I'm like, oh, no one can understand this.
But every time I ask someone a process question or a technique question, they always start by going, of course, it's a very personal thing all the way around. Do you find, it sounds to me like you're a very observant person. Obviously, working in a hospital, oh my gosh, so you're seeing human life right there at its most fragile. Do you, do things stick to you, or are they just, like you'll see a patient that you might have a conversation and be touched by them. You sound like someone who then somewhat files it. And that emotion, that concept, that conversation might fuel a character of yours somewhere. Do you?
Yeah, that's actually very true.
So life sort of is a prophet for you, because you're able to take it and use it. The art is imitating life, so you're just taking life and putting it on the stage, which is
yeah. Exactly. In some ways, you know, I think I'm fortunate enough that, like, you know, some of the work I've done, clinically, is involved the same families over the course of over a decade now. So I've watched a set of children literally grow up from babies into teenagers, and sort of watching them develop as people and watching their personalities come into play, and sort of seeing them as small children, but personalities are present. That's a huge gift to me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're right. In a hospital setting, you know, vulnerability is everywhere. And it does stick with you. And, you know, I spent a lot of time absorbing what I would have considered very tough stuff that I wouldn't say I'm immune to now, but I definitely have a different way to cope and process with it. And I think that for me, art in general and theater and all of those things are very cathartic in terms of how I sort of deal with and channel the emotional impact of, you know, working in that kind of environment on theater patients.
Interesting. Very interesting. Where are you in 5 years? Where are you in 10 years? You are a very ambitious soul. Like I said, the reason I gravitated towards you right now is, like I say, I see you in all quality works. It's like the Oh Him Again thing. Here he is in another award winner, in another well-received play, in another sold-out crowd. There he is. You're almost a luck charm. Where do you see yourself in 5 years, in 10 years? Where's the career headed? Where is Perry going?
Well, you know, I mean, as much as I love TV and film and really sort of getting out there in a more commercial setting, you know, there is this sort of umbilical cord for me to good people and good work, good stories, good writing, strong directors that I admire. And that's really sort of where I gravitate towards, you know, and just inherently. And so any sort of step forward is always, you know, considered a blessing. I feel like I do work towards that. But at the end of the day, you know, I want to take what the most interesting project is. And, you know, whether that's an adaptation of Chekhov on a slave plantation, which I was fortunate to be a part of last year, or, you know, a reimagining of, you know, Caligula, you know, which is, a Roman historical piece written by a French, you know, philosopher in the World War II. Like, you know, to me, that's fascinating. And I feel like that's sort of where I'm constantly gravitating. And so in 5 years, if that leads somewhere other than indie theater, I'm on that ride. And if I am still performing in, you know, then Central Park Shakespeare performances, that's great too. Like, or Riverside Park or any park. You know, for me, it's really about, like, what is the next... And I think that speaks to, like, the sort of John Gielgud, you know, maturation process and sort of where am I as a person and how does that intersect with my work and process and as an actor. And, you know, if commercial work is calling on the door is open. But otherwise, you know, I'm always ready to just dive in and see what the next world I get to play in is, you know.
So you're always going to come home, no matter you can be wherever your career puts you. You're still coming home to indie theater. You're still coming home to the challenge of the project.
Well, yeah, because I think at the end of the day, you know, that's really what has developed me as an actor. You know, I think about my time with Hudson Warehouse or Medicine Show, and those are companies that are incredibly shoestring in their sort of budget, but wildly imaginative in the process. They're rigorous. They're challenging, and at the end of the day, you know, again, we have results of you know, mixed successes, if you will, but at the end of the day, I know that I've grown as an actor. I know that I've discovered a whole new room inside my imagination or in my body, and that gives me fuel to go in a whole different direction or to a whole new height, and, you know, that's really what I'm working for, because at the end of the day, that's what's in my control. That's my job as an actor, is to be able to deliver all those things. And, you know, everyone else is, you know, is going to make their decisions whether they want to hire me or not. But I know that I know the kind of work I want to do, and that speaks doubly as an actor and a storyteller. You know?
Well, if they want their productions to succeed, of course they're going to hire you. It's funny, your answers are very reminiscent. I interviewed Jim Kierstead and Pat Addis, who are two Broadway producers, and they basically said the same thing. Okay, where our career takes us, we go, but we're never going to forget our roots. We're never going to forget the foundation. So it seems whether you're an accidental genius or on purpose genius, you're all thinking in the same way. And that's really marvelous. Perry, thank you so much. I'm going to tell all our listeners about... Oh, my pleasure. I'm going to tell all our listeners about Till We Meet Again, and something tells me I'll be telling all our listeners about the next show you'll be doing, and the next show you'll be doing, and the next show you'll be doing, and you'll be taking no rest from them because they're going to come right after the other. Really appreciate having you on the show, and here's to the new year, and I look forward to seeing you in Till We Meet Again.
Thanks again, Jay. You're the best.
My pleasure. Ciao.
Thank you.
Planet Connections Theater Festivity, in partnership with The Theater at 14th Street Y, presents a powerful new play written by Glory Cadogan and directed by Broadway veteran Tanya Pinkins. Till We Meet Again is currently in previews, opening soon. Log on to the 14th Street Y's website or jmichaelsarts.com to find out time and tickets. And guess who's appearing in it? Perry Yaniv. When I met Jan Ewing, I thought he was a mild-mannered playwright. who used to work for a great metropolitan publishing agency and then decided to become a storyteller in his own right and write plays. That's only part of the story. Jan Ewing was part of the Off-Off-Broadway movement. Jan Ewing worked with Broadway companies, Off-Broadway, television, radio. I couldn't believe the stories he told me. He seemed more like not a mild-mannered reporter, but... Well, you get the idea. So let's chat with Jan Ewing about his new play, Nursery Rhymes.
Hello?
Jay, it's Jan. I thought I'd call you back. Hi there.
Even better. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. I didn't catch the bouquet. Actually, there were only six of us there, but it was kind of fun. We did it at Francis's Tavern, which is always fun.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, it is nice. It is nice. So what can I say here about our wonderful play? I have to say, I'm just in love with the actors. I think I mentioned that to you.
That's
right. So sweet. That's just so wonderful. And you know, I've told you I'm a senior citizen, and so this is a new career for me after I retired from publishing. And it's really fun so far. It's a lot of fun so far.
Oh, I didn't know you were retired. That's interesting.
Oh, no, I am retired, yes. I was in theater for, shall I just babble about this stuff, or you want me to?
Go right ahead. You know what? My recorder is on, so if I'm on the line, you're on the air.
Oh, super duper. Okay. Yeah, well, it goes back a ways, and I spent the first, good part of my life, in the arts. My degrees, I have a degree from Oberlin and a degree from Eastman, both in music, but I got involved in the theater because I like to sing. And I originally started just doing musicals, and then I decided I was becoming too mannered with my musicals, and so I started doing straight plays in order just to teach myself something, to learn something, and started directing, and did a great deal of it up until about 1981, 82. And then I sat down in front of a computer, and I had one of those, I had this second epiphany sort of thing, My first one had been with music when I was five, but I sat down in front of a computer and thought to myself, I've been waiting for this machine all my life, this tool, this wonderful tool, this tool for the mind, because that's exactly what it is, a tool for the mind. It'll do whatever you can think of. It does bad things, too, but it also is a wonderful tool for our creative purposes.
Indeed.
For a writer particularly, you can find out anything you need to know just immediately, like dates and names and check up on facts and this sort of thing. So, I started doing that, and I went in and I sort of started programming, loved that, learned how to do it, and did that for a number of years, and then I went into publishing, and I stayed in publishing until about 4 years ago, at which point, of course, as we all know, American publishing collapsed, and it got all sent to India, and everyone I know in the business, practically even the people that had been at long-term publishing houses, got axed. So I retired.
Sadly, that tool of the mind makes people be able to self-publish and everything like that. So.
Well, that is true, and God, the number of things that are being published. I'm old school, too, in the fact that, I'm a senior citizen, as I told you, and I feel like I'm a real 21st century senior citizen. I thought I'd retired, and then all of a sudden, Eva Heinemann, who, by the way, says hello, and she loves you, talked me into going to start doing some reviewing, and I have been having such a fun time with the reviewing, and it was just sort of accidentally through that I submitted this play for the Winterfest, and they accepted it, and so here I am doing a play for the Winterfest.
So this is your first play ever?
This is my first play ever, when you get right down to it. Now, back in the day, I do think that's a good selling point at this particular juncture. Back in the day, I did do considerable things. I was do you remember Lily Turner?
Oh, sure.
I was associated with Lily with Jacques Brel, is Alive and Well, and in the original show. I was actually Ellie Stone's voice coach. Although nobody could teach her anything, they just had me do it because no one else wanted to.
There you go.
And she was told that she was the pee off of. The New York's pee off, and she wouldn't listen to anybody after that, which is why they tried to get somebody to voice coach her.
Oh, compliments will go to your head.
Right. And then they did a second show called How to Get Rid of It, which was a musical version of Amadei by UNESCO, which lasted about a week, because they didn't know what to do. The Jacques Brel people were putting together a second production,
And you know, the first production they put together was just a, and forgive my first, well, I, this goes out, I shouldn't say that. So I was just going to say a bunch of people in the living room decided to start singing songs, and that's how Jacques Brel came about.
Right.
But they really, really weren't too sure about how to make it, make a show happen under other circumstances. And so the second attempt that they made, Mort Schumann did a wonderful, wonderful version of this, you know, this play, because he was a brilliant man, certainly. He was the fellow that did Jacques Brel, or the, you know, the translator of Jacques Brel. And so I was involved with that. I was the director of the Village Light Opera Group for a while, which is, you know, they're the ones that did the Gilman Sullivan and other things. I did the, I directed the first production of Naughty Marietta in New York City in 60 years for them back in the day. So I was involved with the theater a lot. And then I just, I got to a point where it was, back in that time, I don't think it was quite as, I don't think it was quite as exciting as it is now. It seems to me, now that I'm working back into it again and doing lots of reviews, I've reviewed about 36 plays in the last 6 months or so, I think, something like that. And it seems to me there's so much more activity, and there's so much more activity for people, things for people to do, to get involved in. It was tight back then, and somehow it wasn't as open. I that's all I can say.
Off of Broadway and indie theater back then, you had to go down to places.
Yes, absolutely.
And it was almost dangerous in some cases. Nowadays, the doors are wide open. There are so many theaters that cater to it. There are so many people who are doing exactly like you do, taking their careers in their hands. So it's wonderful.
And a tremendous number of women. And I do have to say that's such a good thing. In the last few months, I've seen so many interesting plays written by women, and also, of course, versions of things. I saw Hamlet at the Hamlet Isn't Dead Company, and they did a feminist version of it with a woman playing Caesar and Mark Antony and all of those things. And otherwise, except for the pronouns, they kept it pretty. Shakespeare, was really fine, and it was really fun. It was very, very interesting.
It's amazing how the sensibilities become so diverse when you change.
Yes. And I saw, I saw the, at the 13th Street Rep, which is interestingly enough, I ran at the 13th Street Rep as an actor for about 3 years with Barry Manilow in the orchestra pit, back, and we were doing The Drunkard, which ran there for years. A fellow named Bro Harrod, produced it. And that's where I met Barry, and I was a friend of his at the time. And actually, we were all at a party the night he met Bette Midler. And I can remember him coming in saying, "I just met the craziest broad on two legs." That's exactly what he said. So I do have a background in all this. And then I sort of stopped and got so involved with this other stuff. But then I've been drawn back into it because of Dear Eva, and I'm enjoying myself a lot.
She's brilliant. She's so marvelous, and she is so supportive of the arts. It's an absolute pleasure. And
she knows.
Excited to do it, which is terrific.
And she knows everybody in town. I mean, I swear, she really, really does.
Yep.
And I don't think she does anything but go to the theater. And I wonder sometimes, I worry about her, do you get any sleep?
Because
she does everything that she can see. I tend to be picky. I go to see the things that are of most interesting to me, and which is lucky. I mean, I'm really lucky to get to do it. So,
speaking of interesting, tell us about your play.
My plot.
Yes. Tell us about the show.
My plot. This is a play about pregnancy. It's a pregnancy in older women, and I wrote this play because I wanted to find a subject that would be relevant and that would stay relevant and that would be interesting to the general public. And it's about a younger couple. When I say younger, I mean 35 to 30. She's 35. He's 37, and he doesn't want a baby. She does. And so she invites a couple of people over for a couple of drinks, in the evening that he doesn't know. And they are an older couple who indeed have had a child and their son is now 12. And so this is just a discussion about why they should do it, why she wants to do it, why he doesn't, and that sort of thing. And I hope it's funny. Everyone says it's funny, and boy, everyone's laughing a lot, and the actors are really... And New York has got so much fine talent, and it's just amazing how wonderful they respond. All these great kids, and they're so beautiful, and I really you know, like to see them do things. It's wonderful to work with them.
That's the other joy of the accessibility of independent theater. In the good old days, you go to this theater, or you're done. Nowadays, the opportunities abound. So the really talented have a chance to shine, which is wonderful.
And the whole casting business was so fascinating. You know, back in the day, we would have an open call, an equity call, and we would sit there for 3 days while everyone stood in lines out the door and got rained on, you know, and they would come up and you'd say, okay, can you sing? Yes. Can you act? Yes, like Olivier. Can you, you know, did you read music? Oh, yes. And they could do anything, of course, until you actually asked them to do something. But the point being that it's now all on the web. Backstage is up there. I put out a casting call. We got 230 some odd submissions for four parts. Looked at them all, looked at their clips, and then interviewed them with Skype and FaceTime. You know, personal interviews at first. And then after deciding upon, you know, the ones that I like specifically, I got them together in groups so they could look at one another. And I think it's worked out very well. I think we have an excellent cast.
A lot of the colds I got in my youth was standing on just those equity lines.
I'm having a little problem understanding you there. It was a little fuzzy. Sorry.
Oh, a bird probably flew overhead, and that was the end of that. I was on many of those calls. I got many a cold waiting in the rain for just so many of those those open calls.
Were you an actor? Were you an actor?
Oh yes. I still am when the check clears. But
I think some. I keep telling the older ones in my play. They're not that old, I mean, compared to me, but they are. And I keep saying, you know, you've got to. I have a number of friends that are older now that are really having quite some success. I have a friend that just did a commercial. He's like close to 80, and he and his wife just took a cruise in the Med. So that's great. You know that there is that kind of opportunity simply because so many people drop out, you know, early on.
You're a mind reader. That was going to be the next question I was going to ask you. You're talking about being part of the previous generation. We have a majority of millennial artists these days. The millennials are all over the place. For older artists, you think there's still a great deal of opportunity? There's still a great many challenges for them out there today?
Yes. Oh, yes, yes. I don't doubt that at all. For one thing, the older artists have something to teach the younger artists. There's a great deal to be said about maturity. I mean, you know, let's face it, and it's absolutely true. And the way I've approached this play, I didn't want to direct it myself at first. I had a young man that was going to direct it for me, a fellow named John Brakey, who's fairly well known. He works out of Washington. He was recently represented in New York City with Laura Bush Killed a Man. Mm-hmm. Which was very, very funny. I think it was, I forgot the theater group that did it, but it was really funny. And John used to work for me when I was directing in regional theater. And it's an interesting situation. I told him that if you want to do it, you got to go to New York, you got to New York. Well, he didn't want to do that. So he said, no, I don't want to. So I came back to New York and, you know, went into an entirely new business at that time. And he went to Houston and became the director of the apprentice program at the Alley Theater. And has had a nice career. At any rate, he was going to direct it, but then he got a job directing a play in Israel, so he had to go there in January. So that's why I wound up directing it myself.
So you are directing your own play?
Yes, I'm directing my own play and producing it. And like I said, I would rather someone else would. But the plays, you know, if I say so myself, it's tight, it's well written. Everyone seems to enjoy it a lot. And more women than I can tell you have said, that's my story, that's my story. And so obviously it's you know, making some things, making people think about it. And so I think it's a good thing. And yes, indeed, the older generation has a great deal to teach these kids. It's true. They are starting to do marvelous things with technology, of course. And I have been saying for years that you know, we weren't going to get great art out of the technology until the generation came of age that had grown up with it.
Yeah.
Other than, you know, and that's beginning to happen. And of course, you know, we've had a revival of so many interesting things in the arts. In our life now, opera is a perfect example. I'm an opera fan, and you know the Metropolitan Opera is now hiring Broadway people, and it's just incredible what they're doing.
Okay.
And with all of the wonderful new recording techniques, and all of these singers are learning how to act, and all of these things are going out and broadcast all over the world. And 30 million people see a new production at the Metropolitan Opera. So there's this great rebirth, I think. And more young people I see every day are making great music. And, you know, and I'm quite, I think that's very positive, and I'm happy about that.
I think we're going to see a renaissance of people who've never experienced opera now have the opportunity. People who've never seen a straight play or a drama or Shakespeare now have it at their fingertips. Do you think we're going to get some form of artistic renaissance that everyone is going to be? Because for a while things were very splintered, and even now things are splintered when you talk about awards and things. Do you think people are going to say, "Well, I can see it, so let me go to it"?
Yeah. I think that that's possible, because if they're seeing that these are not, you know, I mean, the whole business of opera when the fat lady sings, well, there aren't any fat ladies anymore. And, you know, it is one of the, you know, the great arts of Western civilization. I mean, and you're just saying, oh, I find it boring. Well, yes, indeed, some of it is boring, but some of it is absolutely stunning. And so, you know, you really, you know, you can't, you know, and they're doing wonderful things at Lincoln Center in general. I recently saw Waiting for Godot. There, which I thought I reviewed very favorably, and I was so thrilled with it. I've seen it four times in my life, and I can remember the first time I was like 13, and of course all we wanted to know was, well, who is Godot? Well, who are they waiting for? And of course that doesn't matter at all. It's the fact that they're waiting that is so symbol, exactly. That is so important, you know, and what they're doing with their lives while they're waiting. And the production they just had in Lincoln Center was stunning, because they all sounded and looked like they'd just been drawn out of James Joyce, you know, like they'd just come from Dublin that day. And there was something about the sound of the way they talked, but it was just a really, really an eye-opener, and I enjoyed it immensely.
There was another one not long ago that did it in Yiddish.
Yes, they're doing a new version. Are they bringing that to Broadway soon? That's a Yiddish version?
Wow, yes. I'm not sure if it's going to Broadway, but I remember hearing about it being in Yiddish. Do you think
I know they're bringing the Yiddish fiddler to Broadway.
That will never close. That's become a phenomenon. I look forward to seeing that. Do you think even cultures will, the cultural barriers will disappear now that people who don't speak Yiddish are going to see the Yiddish theater, now that people who don't speak Spanish or Italian or whatever, they're going to see it's great
art?
I don't know.
You know, it depends upon how many people that are going to see things actually think about them. You know, so many people just go and they want to be entertained. I like to be mentally stimulated by things. I mean, I pick that kind of play.
Sure. Sure.
You know, I'm fascinated by it. And since I've been doing all of my reviews, I have come to have such a respect for Shakespeare. And I know that sounds presumptuous. But what I have begun to respect is how beautifully he crafted his plays, you know, as well as the gorgeous music or the gorgeous language and all that business. They're also well crafted. There's just enough time for someone to have a little drink and then go off and do something. You know, this scene melds into this scene, and it's also so well done. And, you know, and his plays aren't all that long. Not The Tempest. Well, The Tempest is a perfect example. I saw the production at the Public Theater they recently did of the one they'd taken on the streets of Midsummer Night's Dream, which was really, really charming. And, you know, and once again, they were quite comfortable with the language. And I'm glad to hear that. It seems to me that for many years, we've avoided the skills necessary for our various arts.
Yeah.
I mean, actors were not learning how to act. They weren't learning how to walk across the stage. They were just learning how to emote. And you do need skills. You need to know how to make an entrance and how to turn around and how to find the light on the stage. It's astounding when I run into actors now that have no idea how to find a light. I could find a light with my eyes closed. You know, what are they doing? So at any rate, so these skills are wonderful. I mean, reading music is another perfect example. The first time when I first came to New York, I got hired in the chorus for something, and I don't remember what it was. And I went to the first rehearsal, and I came prepared. I had 2 degrees in music before I came here, and I knew how to do it. And because I came prepared, because I assumed that's what you did in New York. So I got hired for this, and we sat there for 2 weeks while the pianist hammered out the chorus parts, and all of those people learned it. And I learned mine in about 30 minutes, and the others took 2 weeks. And they went through $200,000 while they were doing that.
Oh,
and all I could think to myself, something's wrong here. What's wrong with this picture? You know?
You're not alone in saying that. I've seen many an interview, if you will, where some of the grand old performers of way back when are completely bothered by microphones, by how many times understudies go on, by not knowing how to project. So that's a major issue. So the craft is necessary nowadays.
You know, you were talking about this microphone thing, and I have to agree with you there. Now, I don't mind mic'd voices and mic music when it's not, out of hassle. But I reviewed Be More Chill, which I like a lot. Which, you know, when they were at the on 43rd Street up here, they're going to open, I believe, in February on Broadway, and I reviewed Be More Chill, and I liked the play a lot, and visually it was stunning, but my heavens, they amplified it to the point of madness. About halfway through the second act, I got to a point where I had to actually leave the room just simply because it was too loud.
Oh, wow.
I'm not saying that as an old guy. I don't mind sound, but I think these people that do the sound on Broadway and what have you are losing their hearing, and they're just turning it up so loud. And I mean, the walls were shaking. The audience, everyone loved it, and I liked it too, except for this particular problem.
Gotcha.
But, you know, and it's nice when people are able to project. A lot of it, too, has to do with the fact that there's so much film training and video training.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's an entirely different kind of acting, as you know. And so you have to, and I'm yelling at my people. I'm not yelling at them, but so far, speak up, project. And
yep.
Of course, we haven't even gotten on a stage yet because this, you know, this Winterfest thing, they're very generous at the Winterfest, by the way. We get a 5-hour tech rehearsal, which is more than anybody, gives anybody, But so far, it's all been in practice rooms, listen to me, in rehearsal rooms. And, so we've got like 5 hours in which to rehearse and make them all get loud enough so I can hear them. I think they'll be fine. I mean, I'm not worried about it. But,
I think,
you know, it is something interesting.
It's terrific if it's just, okay, let's make sure each intricate word is heard. But when it has to be there as a crutch, or when the actor can't be heard or can't be understood without it, now we're talking a major institutional problem, if you will.
Now,
you have been through it all. You're the definition of the word journeyman, I'm now hearing, and I'm very impressed. And now your first play is Breathing Life. What's next? Where do we find you when this closes?
Well, now I've got a screenplay I have to sell. I had an agent. I sent this to some agents a while back, and an agent got back to me and said, "This is the funniest thing I've ever read. I can't sell this one. Give me your next one. But boy, is this funny." And I thought, you know, as I'm sure you're aware of this too, selling a screenplay, if you're not in the film business already, is really, really tough.
Yeah.
I mean, just getting anybody to listen to it, our screenplay is about tennis. My screenplay is about a tennis tournament for American Express that I managed years ago. It was very, very funny. And so I wrote it with the press guy that we had hired to go out on the road. I was working out of the American Express office down here managing the thing. And he was... And he was out on the road, you know, taking care of all of the tennis players. And it was so funny. And it was such, American Express was sponsoring a second level tennis tournament, you know, and nobody had bothered to find. And they had done that because the new president of American Express, who I believe was Louis Gerstner at the time, liked tennis. Well, the old president liked golf. And so when the new president got in, he had a tennis tournament just to get back at the other guy, right? And
it's nice to have so much money and so much influence to do that.
Yes, it is. It is. And so he was just getting it. And no one had bothered to find out that the public doesn't care about second level. They care about the medals and the biggies, but not about second level very much.
Right.
And so it was, from the beginning, it was chaos. And that's what my screenplay is about. And I like to get some attention. Actually, my partner that I wrote it for, had an appointment. He was a tennis, he had a few ATP points, you know, there's tennis points. And he got an interview with the fellow that did Chariots of Fire a number of years ago. And he was interested in doing, and the guy that did that, I've forgotten his name, he wanted to do a play or a film about tennis. And so my partner, or my guy said, I'm going to go see him. I'll take him a copy of the script, of course. Well, he did. And so he's sitting across the table from this guy that did Chariot of Fire, who's looking for a tennis script, and said, "Would you take a look at this?" And the guy said, "Oh, no, I'm sorry, I can't, because then you'd say we stole it and blah, 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 blah."
Uh-huh.
And that was that. So we couldn't even get the guy who wanted to do a play to read it. But I suppose that's the next thing. And I also have an idea for another play, a rather serious one, about Ivan the Fourth, which was a Russian czar. He was crowned czar at the age of 3, deposed by Catherine the Great when he was 5, put into prison and kept there for the rest of his life.
Oh my God.
And it's a very, very interesting subject. And I think, so I have been thinking about a play on that subject for quite some time.
So you're here to stay. You scream retired at the top of this, but I'm calling bullshit on that. You're here to stay. You have screenplays. You have plays. You have history. We're going to hear your name many, many more times in this interview.
Well, I certainly thank you for that. That's what Lily always thought. And, she was a dear, Lily Turner. She was, in fact, Lily got me into the Musicians Union. They hired me to do music on their second play. And she said, "Are you in the Musicians Union?" I said, "Oh," I said, "No." She said, "Oh, come on." So we walked, we trundled down to 801 and walk in the door. And she says, "Hi, George, give this guy a card." Well, that's how hard it was for me to get an 801 card. And when I think of how hard it is for some of these kids to get an equity and to get into these unions from outside, as I'm sure you're aware here too, back in our day, or in my day, I don't think you're as old as I am, but back in my day, you couldn't get an equity job unless you had an equity card. You couldn't even go to an audition unless you already had an equity card, and you couldn't.
My day is close to your day in that time period, so I know.
And we couldn't get an equity card unless we, unless we already had a job. So, it was a real mess. It was tough, but anyway, we all managed. And I am a member of Equity as well, being an 801. But I did not withdraw from Equity, I'm afraid, and I would probably, if I ever wanted to do anything about that, I would have to, I don't think I'd have to pay up all of my dues, but God knows what it'll be after that many years, we are an equity-proof showcase, by the way.
That's wonderful.
Yes, we are.
For the festival, that's really excellent. Good for you. Well, what am I saying? Of course you're going to be pleased.
I sent you a copy of the play. I don't know if you, did you have a chance to look at it?
I know
you're very busy.
I have not. I'm off the charts, but before you close, I'm definitely going to read that play. You have a whole bunch of reviewers. You check your email. I sent you a whole bunch of things regarding your show.
My partner said that, and I haven't looked at them yet. I just walked in the door, before I started talking to you. But I'll take a look at them all, and then I'll get back to you.
Great. All the press is going out for your show. It is a thrill to speak to you. I'm sure our listeners are going to enjoy your play. I will make sure there's links attached to this podcast to make sure everyone knows how to come and see your show and how to meet the journeyman that is Jan Ewing.
Well, that would be great, and I certainly appreciate your interest. As I said, Eva speaks very highly of you, and I love her a lot. I'm starting to get a little bit of a reputation as a reviewer, and I am enjoying that immensely. I don't have any interest in reviewing outside of her bailiwick and what have you, because she's the master here. I mean, she knows
everybody.
Indeed. Yeah.
She's going to be on this podcast probably before the end of January.
I believe she's going to be on your podcast. Right. Oh, cool. Let me know when that's going to be, too, so I can...
I always spread the love.
Okay. Have I said... I can talk a lot. You guessed that already. Right?
And you're very intelligent in everything you say. Normally, I jump in, but why bother? When brilliance comes out of one mouth, I don't need to open up mine.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that. I appreciate it very much.
It is a pleasure speaking to you. I look forward to speaking to you again and hearing all the success about
and
your projects.
And love to meet you soon, okay?
Definitely. Count on it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if you need any other information or what have you, why, I'm here. And thanks so much. And tell everybody to come see Nursery Rhymes on the 14th, 16th, and 19th of January.
For the
and,
New York Winter Fest at the Hudson
yes.
Theater.
And we're going to move this play on. I really think so, because it's commercial and it's got a good message. It's a happy play. It's pro baby. It is. It ends happily, What was I saying? Oh, and I don't see it as a Broadway play particularly, but I certainly think it could have a respectable off-Broadway run. I really do.
That's
what I'm aiming for at the moment.
That's terrific. Much
okay.
luck with that. Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you so much.
And
we'll talk
soon.
Again soon.
You bet.
Okay.
Ciao.
Bye-bye.
After months of preparation, Nursery Rhymes will premiere at the New York Winterfest 2019 Play Competition in New York City on January 14th and 16th at 9 p.m. and January 19th at 6 p.m. The venue is the lovely Hudson Guild Theater at 441 West 26th Street between 9th and 10th Avenues in Chelsea. Please log on to jmichaelsarts.com for ticket information.
That was Mary Elizabeth Macari. Bit of trivia. We're talking about Journeyman. Well, she's a journeywoman. Mary worked on Broadway. Mary worked off-Broadway. Mary was a designer. She is an artistic director. She is a teacher. She has sung opera. She sings jazz. We're going to have an interview with her in the coming weeks, and you're going to hear just about all the things that she has done in her marvelous career. And now, after we've done with the adventures, we are getting on our white horse, and off we go.
Off we go.
Next week, there'll be more interesting people that make the theater a marvelous place, and the theater makes New York the place to be. Hi-yo, Silver! Away!
Bye.
See you next week.
Bye!
His brother's
we'll never get out.